This call is being recorded by the meeting organizer. By staying on the call, you are giving your consent to being recorded.
Hi, my name is George Tormez. I'm actually a lead attorney in the 11th Circuit. One quick correction, but Kanisha, I guess, kind of got me to cover this month's topic, which was for the 16th Circuit. But I'm down in Miami, Florida. And I'm going to be talking about the child hearsay exception. Before I start, I kind of want to kind of give you a disclaimer. I looked up all the cases that I cite in the presentation, but if you're going to use any of these cases, you should read them thoroughly before you actually go and use them in court. A lot of these cases are very fact-specific, so you want to make sure that your facts kind of match up with what's happening in the case that you're citing. As well as you're going to want to key cite it and Shepherdize it just to make sure it's still good law. I did it for this presentation, and they all appear to still be good law, but you never know when things change, so make sure you make sure it's still good law before you use it. I want to start off with just a general definition of what hearsay is. Most of you hopefully already know what hearsay is, but it's basically is a statement other than one made by the declarant while testifying at the trial or hearing offered into evidence to prove the truth of the matter asserted. And the reason why it's usually not admissible is because it doesn't really give the other side the opportunity to cross-examine that witness who made the statement, and it doesn't give the judge or the jury, whoever the trier of fact is, the ability to observe the demeanor of the person who made the statement. That being said, there are 28 specific exceptions to the hearsay prohibition, and today we're going to be talking about one in particular, the statement of the victim child. In the PowerPoint that was emailed out, I'm on the third slide. In the third slide, I just literally copied and pasted the statute that deals with the child hearsay exception for your reference, so that you can have the full statute if you need it in the future. In the fourth slide, all right, so the first thing you need to know about child hearsay is that the exception only applies to child victim statements. So the statement must be made by a child who's under the physical, mental, emotional, or developmental age of 16. And that age requirement is calculated at the time that the child made the statement. So the child can be over 16 at the time of trial, but if they made the statement prior to them being 16, the statement can still come in. The one thing to remember is it says physical, mental, emotional, or developmental age. So a child can be over 16 and have a developmental age of below 16, but for that you would need some expert testimony to speak as to what the child's mental or emotional or developmental age is. So the statement has to be made by a child under 16, and the statements have to describe an act of child abuse or neglect or sexual abuse. That's something that sometimes people tend to forget, that the child has to be a victim of abuse or neglect or sexual abuse, and that the statements have to be related to that abuse. The exception does not apply to statements by children who are witnesses, but not victims of the abuse. But we can always make an argument that witnessing abuse or neglect may actually be abuse or neglect as well. And so if a child witnesses domestic violence in the home, they can technically be a victim of abuse or neglect just by the act of witnessing the domestic violence. The same with sexual abuse. Witnessing sexual abuse or witnessing someone perform a sexual act, just the fact that it's done in front of a minor can be abuse or sexual abuse or neglect. Now, the basic elements of the child hearsay motion, I basically put in slide number 6, and I tried to make it as simple as possible. So assuming that it's a statement made by a child victim about abuse neglect or sexual abuse, in order for it to be admissible, it either has to be found to be reliable and trustworthy, and the child has to testify, or it's found reliable and trustworthy, and then the child is found unavailable to testify. Then there also has to be the added element of corroborating evidence. So there's two ways you can bring it in. Either the child testifies, and all you have to do is make sure that it's reliable and trustworthy, or the child doesn't testify but is found to be unavailable, and there's corroborating evidence to support the statements that the child is making. So I'm going to break down the different elements, and I'm going to start with the need to, for the court to find that the statements were reliable and trustworthy. So the court must make a finding that the hearsay statement is reliable and from a trustworthy source. It's important to understand that the statement has to be found reliable and trustworthy just based on the statements themselves. You cannot use corroborating evidence to argue that the statements are reliable. So if you have a child that states that they were sexually abused, and then you have some medical, physical evidence that corroborates that statement, the court has to make the finding first that the statement is reliable without taking into account the fact that there is other physical evidence of the abuse. If the court uses that physical evidence in its finding that that the statements were reliable and trustworthy, that could be found to be error because the court has to make that reliability and truthworthiness finding without looking at anything else. So what factors can the court look at, and really what do they have to look at when they're making the determination that the statements are reliable? So the statute lists some factors. The age of the child, the nature and duration of the abuse, the relationship to the offender, the reliability of the statement, and the reliability of the child. In addition to the statutory factors, the courts have created other factors that the court should look at, and these are not non-exclusive. It doesn't mean that you're limited to these factors. These are just factors that the court should look at, but you can also include any other factors that you think are relevant and show that these statements are reliable and trustworthy. So in Townstead v. State, the court listed several factors for the court to consider. They include spontaneity, whether the child used child-appropriate language, specificity of statements, consistency of the statements, whether it was made at the first opportunity, whether it came from questions or whether it was a spontaneous statement, whether there was motive to fabricate whatever the statement was, the ability of the child to distinguish between reality and fantasy, any improper influence, and the vagueness of the accusations. All of these factors you can kind of play with depending on the facts of your case. For example, the child appropriate language. I've had cases where a child uses very childlike language to describe sexual abuse. They weren't using terminology that an adult would be using. So you can argue that, you know, they're explaining it based on their child's perspective. If they were being coached, they would have said something, they might have said something that an adult would have said. With regards to all of these factors, it's important to note that they don't all have to be in favor of reliability or trustworthiness. You don't have to meet all of these factors. You just need to make an argument to the court based on the factors that you think prove that the statements are reliable, that whatever statements you're providing should be found reliable and trustworthy. The child does not have to be found to be competent in order for the hearsay statements to be found reliable. And there is a citation I put in the PowerPoint, PD versus State. So if the child is found to be incompetent to actually testify, you can still get the hearsay statements in. It's not a bar to them coming in, as long as there are other indications of reliability that the court can base its reliability finding in. Trustworthiness, it's pretty much the same thing as the reliable factors. except the court could consider whether the witness has a personal stake. So under trustworthiness, the court is looking at the person that's bringing in these statements, so your witness. Are they trustworthy? So an example where someone can make an argument that the statements may not be trustworthy because the person who's the witness who's bringing in the statements is not a trustworthy person might be in a case where you have a custody dispute between two parents, and one parent is bringing in the statements against the other parent. There it can be argued that the statements are not trustworthy because there is a bias or there is an incentive to make up these statements by the person who's the witness. And again, all of this is kind of case specific. If you have a CPI or a police or a guardian ad litem testifying as to statements, you can make the argument that they're a neutral third party, that they have no personal stake in any custody decision or anything involving the child, so that they should be found to be trustworthy sources for these statements. All right, so once the child is found, once the court determines that the statements are reliable and trustworthy, then we have to look to see whether the child is going to testify. So if the child is testifying, they have to be subject to cross-examination. It doesn't have to be a very aggressive cross-examination, but you have to allow the other party to ask questions of the child. In MH, the Department of Health, in that case, the testimony was in-camera testimony. So in-camera testimony is appropriate and does count as testimony. So if you have a child that may not be able to necessarily testify in open court in front of the defendant, you can file a motion for protective order and have the child testify in camera. The important part is to make sure that the parent or whoever the statements are against has an opportunity to cross-examine the child. So their attorney has to be able to cross-examine. Here in Miami, we normally do it through closed-circuit video. The child would be in a different room. Depending on the situation, either the judge or the attorneys will be asking the child questions. But there's an opportunity for the parent to be able to see what's happening in the room, hear the testimony, and to communicate with their attorney as to what questions they should ask the child during cross-examination. Also, case law has found that a videotaped deposition of a child taken pursuant to Section 92.53 can also count as testimony. Now, oftentimes you have a child who, during the testimony, makes inconsistent statements, basically statements different than what they stated early on in the case and what you're trying to bring in through the child hearsay. And that's fine. In independency cases, the Supreme Court of Florida held that hearsay statements, even if inconsistent with a child's in-court testimony, are admissible as substantive evidence in a dependency hearing once they have satisfied the stringent reliability safeguards established in the child hearsay exception. And the cite to that is Department of Health and Rehabilitative Services versus MB. Now, there is another case where the Florida Supreme Court distinguished that one case. It's a criminal case, and it's Bieber v. State. In that case, they basically said that in the criminal context, if the child's testimony is not consistent with the statements made that you're trying to bring in through the child hearsay, that it is not enough to sustain a conviction. So it shouldn't come in. A lot of times a parent's attorney may cite to Bieber. make sure that you point out that in Beaver, the court specifically distinguishes MB by stating that there are heightened due process protections, and in particular, they talk about the confrontation clause of the Constitution to distinguish between a dependency setting and a criminal setting. There is no case law that I could find that talks about termination of parental rights. I would argue that termination of parental rights proceedings should follow the same rule as the dependency proceeding, even though it is a slightly higher standard through clear and convincing. The main objective of the proceeding is not punitive, it's the protection of the child, and that it's not such a high burden as beyond a reasonable doubt. And the court in Beaver actually makes a point of saying that that in criminal proceedings the goal is punitive, not protection of the child, and that's why they had a higher standard for admitting the child hearsay in that case versus in MB, which is a dependency case. There is case law that seems to imply that child hearsay alone is enough to sustain a dependency. In AB, in the interest of AB, in that case, the department basically, it's a little convoluted. There are a lot of issues with regards to the case, partly because the trial court kind of mixed in the trial with the hearsay motion, and things got a little bit confusing. But the main point of that case is that the court held that the department made a prima facie case for dependency, and essentially the only real substantive evidence that they presented of the dependency was the child hearsay statements. So that seems to imply that child hearsay alone may be enough to sustain a dependency. That being said, if you have other evidence, if you have any evidence that corroborates the allegations of the child hearsay, in the child hearsay, I would present it because you want to make sure you have as much evidence as possible just to ensure that you have enough to sustain whatever dependency or TPR you get out of the case. Okay. So in cases where the child does not remember making the statement, so if you have a child who testifies in court and then someone asks the child, do you remember telling the child protection investigator this? And the child says, no, I don't remember telling the child protection investigator this. That's fine. Hearsay statements are still admissible even if the child testifies that he or she does not remember making the statement. And that's based off case law, DWG versus Department of Children and Families. Now, I'm going to distinguish that later on because this is when the child does not remember making the statement. If the child doesn't remember the allegations, a different issue comes to play, but I'll talk about that in a second. If the child is unavailable, so if the child cannot testify, you can still go forward as long as you have corroborating evidence. But there has to be a finding that the child is unavailable to testify. And the court is required to make that finding. The child is not required to be examined by the court for the court to make the determination that he or she is unavailable to testify. And I cite to Perez v. State for that. But there has to be some evidence presented. Now, Florida statute defines what unavailability to testify is, and that's in section 90.804, parentheses 1. And in there it lists what the court may determine to be unavailable to testify. The first is privilege. So if you have a witness who's asserting a privilege, so let's say you have a minor who made some hearsay, who you're trying to get hearsay statements of, and they're refusing to testify because it could implicate them in a criminal case for whatever reason, and they're taking their Fifth Amendment right to against self-incrimination. In that case, the child would be unavailable to testify because they're claiming a privilege, and that's the reason they're not testifying. Another reason that a child can be found unavailable to testify is if they persistently refuse to testify despite court order. So if you bring a child into the stand and you ask them to testify and they just refuse to, and the judge orders them to testify and they still refuse to, the court can find the child to be unavailable to testify. Lack of memory. If the child doesn't remember the incidents that involve the abuse or neglect or sexual abuse, the court can find them unavailable to testify. And when I mentioned earlier, this is different from remembering whether they made the statements. In that case, the statements can come in. In this case, if the child does not remember the actual events and they're not able to testify because they can't remember about the events, in that case, the child will be declared unavailable. And you may still be able to bring it in, but you have to have corroborating evidence. Another reason a child can be found unavailable is the death or then existing physical or mental illness or infirmity. So if a child passes away, obviously they're unavailable. Or if a child has some accident or some other mental illness or infirmity where they're unable to testify, the court can find them unavailable to testify. And then the final reason, per section 90.804, parentheses 1, is that you were unable to get the child to come to testify. But you have to have followed the procedure. You would have had to try to subpoena them and follow all process and reasonable means to try to get the child to come and testify. Now, in addition to these, this statutory definition of unavailability to testify, the child hearsay exception actually has an added factor or an added definition of what unavailability can be. And its unavailability shall include a finding by the court that the child's participation in trial or proceeding would result in substantial likelihood of severe emotional or mental harm. So essentially, if you can prove that the child is in substantial likelihood of severe emotional or mental harm, the court can declare the child unavailable. For this, you would need some expert testimony. There is case law that a therapist's testimony is sufficient to support this finding. And the case law regarding that is Perez v. State and Seaman versus Florida. Okay. So if a child can't remember the events that the statements are related to, the child is considered unavailable to testify, so you would need corroborating evidence. If the child is found to be an incompetent witness, the child is considered unavailable. And again, you would need competent corroborative evidence in order to be able to bring it in. All right, so if you get the finding that the child is unavailable, you're also going to need to present some form of corroborative evidence in order for the hearsay statements to come in if the child is not testifying. Now, corroborative evidence has been defined by case law as evidence which tends to confirm the abusive or neglectful acts that are the subject of the child victim hearsay. So case law has kind of established or made given us some guidance as to what is and is not corroborative evidence. Other hearsay statements is not corroborative evidence. So if you have a child disclosing something to a therapist and then disclosing something to a CPI, and you try to bring in both hearsay statements and you argue that one hearsay statement corroborates the other, that doesn't count as corroborative evidence. So it has to be something other than other hearsay statements. Testimony that the child is telling the truth is not corroborating evidence. And in fact, it could be a reversible error to allow a witness, expert or non-expert, to testify that in their opinion the child is telling the truth. So be careful with your witnesses kind of giving opinion testimony as to whether the child is telling the truth or not. Now, what is corroborative evidence? Well, courts have found that physical evidence of abuse is corroborative evidence. So if you have a physical abuse case and you have pictures of bruises or witnesses that can testify as to bruising on a child, that could be corroborative evidence. Same thing as the medical exam in a sexual abuse case. Behavioral evidence of abuse may also be corroborative evidence. In Teal v. Department of Children and Families, in that case, it was a DV case, and the corroborative evidence was that the child became frightened at seeing the father at a visitation. Another thing that could be corroborative evidence is evidence of similar acts. If you have a parent who has, you have evidence of that parent physically abusing another one of their children, and the allegations or the statement you're trying to get in is about physical abuse of another child, that could be corroborative evidence. The key here is that it says similar acts, so you may have to play with what constitutes similar. So an example might be if you have a sexual abuse case and the parent is, there's evidence of rape of an adult or rape of someone who's not a relative. Whether that's similar or not may be open for debate, but just use whatever facts you have in your case to try to argue that the acts are similar and that they should be considered corroborative evidence. Testimony by an expert that the child is acting in a manner consistent with a child who has been abused has been found to be corroborative evidence. Again, you're going to need to be able to make the connection that the child's behavior can be connected to the allegation of abuse. And then finally, defendant's own statements can be corroborative evidence. If you have a defendant who confessed to a police officer, that could be corroborative evidence. Or if you have a defendant that made admissions that corroborate the details of the child hearsay statements, that could also be corroborative evidence. Before a court can admit the child hearsay statements, they have to have an evidentiary hearing to ascertain the reliability of the child's out-of-court statements. So we talked about all the reliability factors before. That requires an actual hearing, and then the court has to make specific findings of fact on the record before the court admits the evidence under this exception. And the court's conclusory recitals of the statutory requirements relating to reliability are not sufficient. You have to make sure that if the court is making a finding that the statements are reliable and trustworthy, that they make specific findings that point to actual facts that were presented at the evidentiary hearing in support of its finding. Just a general statement or general statements regarding the court finding the statements reliable, or simply stating the different factors but not applying specific facts from your particular case to those factors is not sufficient for the court to admit the hearsay statements. It's usually best practice, if you can, to have an order written out that actually addresses the factors and how the evidence that you've presented support the reliability and trustworthiness of the statements. That way it's clear on paper that the actual findings were made prior to the statements being accepted into evidence. Okay. So there is, I have a lot of parents' attorneys who will argue confrontation clause whenever we're trying to get in child hearsay. And I just want to point out that the confrontation clause of the Constitution only applies to criminal prosecutions. If you look it up, it specifically states in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to be confronted with the witnesses against him. So if you have a parent's attorney who's arguing that admitting the hearsay statements is a violation of the parent's right to confrontation, especially when you don't have the child testifying because they're found unavailable to testify. You can tell the court that the Confrontation Clause does not apply to non-criminal cases. A lot of times the parents' attorneys will cite to Crawford v. Washington, which is a criminal case. Crawford does not apply to our dependency or TPR cases. And in that case, they kind of go into what's considered whether the statement can come in regarding the Confrontation Clause when a child is not testifying or when the victim is not testifying. Again, if they try to argue that, just argue that the Confrontation Clause does not apply to our cases. So today I only covered this one particular hearsay exception. There are other hearsay exceptions, and they can all potentially apply to statements made by a child. So this is not the exclusive method of admitting child hearsay. The reason why I put this in is because I had a judge once who was under the impression that the only way that you can bring in a child statement, hearsay statements in, was under this one exception. So when we were arguing to bring in statements under a different exception, I believe it was the excited utterance, he wanted us to also prove the hearsay exceptions for the child victim hearsay exception, all the elements for that. Each hearsay exception is alone and freestanding. So if you can bring in a statement under a different hearsay exception, you're able to do that if you can prove the elements for that hearsay exception, and you don't have to prove the exception, the elements for this particular exception that we discussed today. Two possible exceptions that might be useful is spontaneous statement, and that's basically a statement made describing or explaining an event as it's happening or immediately thereafter unless untrustworthy. So an example of that would be maybe if a child called grandma while they were witnessing the mother being beaten by the father. And then the child was describing what was happening to grandma. You can argue that was a spontaneous statement, and grandma may be able to come in and say what the child was saying and describing, because the child was saying something as it was happening. Excited utterance is similar. It's a statement relating to a startling event made while under the stress of the excitement. So if a child had some type of traumatic event, and shortly after witnessing that event, they describe that event or speak about it while still under the stress of the event, they may fall under this excited utterance exception. And if you think you can get in statements under more than one exception, you should try all of them just as a backup in case, for whatever reason, you didn't meet all the elements for the child victim hearsay exception, but maybe you might be able to meet the elements for the excited utterance or spontaneous statement exception. Some practical considerations, when to file and hear the hearsay motion. It's probably best practice to file the motion in advance of trial. Now, whether you actually hear the motion at a pretrial or at a trial or at the day of trial, or whether you specially set, should kind of be a strategic decision on your part, and also you need to take into account what your judge prefers. I've had judges that prefer to do these types of motions before the day of trial. I've had judges who want to hear it all at the day of trial. Personally, I prefer to do it at the day of trial because oftentimes you have to have the same witnesses for your child hearsay motion as that you would, and you would use those same witnesses at the trial. So it doesn't make sense to bring in the witnesses more than once. But again, it's kind of your preference, and then whatever your judge prefers is the ultimate deciding factor. Now, while the statute does not specifically state a notice requirement for non-criminal cases, the statute does create a notice requirement for criminal cases. Due process would require that you provide notice to the other party that you intend to seek the admission of child hearsay statements at a trial. So notice would be most likely in the form of a written motion where you list all the statements that you're seeking to introduce and where you state the reasons why they are reliable and trustworthy. So make sure you have a good motion that lists everything. I've drafted motions when I have an audio recording or a video recording of the child's interview. And in the motion I'll state that there's a recording that has been provided to all the parties and that we're seeking to admit that recording into evidence under the child hearsay exception. And then I'll go ahead and list the main statements in the recording just to be on the safe side, to make sure that they're on notice as to what the statements are. And try to get the actual motion filed within reasonable time before the trial, so that the parents' attorneys don't have the ability to argue that they were not on notice and they're not able to argue a child hearsay motion on the day of trial. Does anyone have any questions?
I don't have questions. I just wanted to say very good job, George. I really appreciate it. A couple things I just wanted to sort of give you information. So the MH case seems to indicate that a child can be a victim if he saw his mother being murdered by his father. Yeah. I was not successful arguing that in a case in 98, but I won the TPR anyway, so... and it was a sibling that the parents had murdered. So I didn't fight it. I didn't, you know, appeal the ruling on the hearsay because we won the TPR anyway. But I agree with you. You can make that argument. Just get somebody to testify that this child is a victim by virtue of what they witnessed in the home. That's a really good point. Make sure the court, when the court's making findings, they also find that the source of the information is reliable, so the whole Thompson, no axe to grind factors, all that sort of thing. So really good job. Thanks, George.
You're welcome. Oh, one final thing I wanted to kind of say. When you're looking at different case law with regards to the child victim hearsay exception, the first thing you should look at is to see if it's a criminal case or a civil case. Because if the facts, if you can maybe distinguish it a little bit, you may be able to argue that particular case shouldn't apply to dependency cases because of the higher burden of a criminal prosecution. So
absolutely.
Kind of play with the facts if you think it's kind of close or if you have a case that's really not helpful to you, but it's a criminal case and you think you have some civil cases that are a little bit more helpful to you and kind of say something that's a little bit different. Just make sure you point that out.
All right, everybody, I want to just give one last reminder. On the R drive, we have the time materials for each month where you find the materials, and I sent out an email, saved today's PowerPoint from George there. And also we're backlogged a little bit on the CLE for the past couple months, and we're working with the bar to try to get that straightened up so we can get caught up on some of the CLEs to be posted on there. So with that, I've got nothing else. Everybody have a great weekend. Thanks for all that you do all the time. Make our mission successful. Here.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye.